Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this episode of Risk, you'll hear Hillary McCormick.
I was trying to figure out if he was really... How Christian was he? Was he the wait till marriage type? Was he the sneak around type? This was my focus. It really shouldn't have been, but it was.
That and more. But first, if you have a story about threats to American democracy and how they might have affected your life in recent years, pitch it to us. Let's get some stories that exemplify how crucial it is to preserve and strengthen our democracy rather than allow even more of our rights to be stolen from us. Remember, you can always pitch us your stories at risk-show.com/submissions.
We'll be right back.
Now here's the show. Hello, folks. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison. This is Blonde Fire behind me now with a song called
Waves.
Waves, which is also the name of this episode. This song first appeared on the podcast on one of our Halloween episodes in 2012. Now, in a little bit, we're going to hear from Hillary McCormick, but before that, a story from Ashaya Amave. Ashaya runs a beautiful, curated social event in New York City called Sharing to Share, and she attended one of our curated social events that we call What's Your Story, which is where we first heard her sharing a much shorter version of the story you're about to hear. We asked her to flesh it out a bit and do it at a Risk live show at Caveat in New York a few months back. So here is Ashaya Amave now with a story we call The Dildo Debacle.
I am thinking about leaving New York. I want to move. I'm a native New Yorker, and I've been kind of doing this farewell tour. Every time I go somewhere, I'm like, oh, I remember that. I remember that. So I'm from Bed-Stuy, and I went to school in Park Slope. And I passed both my elementary and my middle school there. When I passed my middle school, I was like, oh my God, the shit that I got into here. So let me tell you one of those stories. When I was in the sixth grade, I started a new school, and I went to a Catholic school. So you already know. I feel like Catholic school kids just have it, like, in their system to just rebel. Like, they just want to do something different. They just trying. So it was so funny because it was, like, people from all over. Like, the school was in Park Slope, but there were people there from South Slope. So we have, like, you know, Irish Catholics. We got, like, you know, old school Italians from Brooklyn, and I'm from Bed-Stuy, so we had that, Fort Greene, like literally all over. But when that bell rung, it was like clockwork. We all went to rolling up our skirts, the guys were taking off their ties, like we're all trying to do different things with our hair. And it was like, looking as an adult, I feel like the teachers are like, oh my God, these kids are trying so hard to be different and to be bad, but it's really not that serious. So that's one of the things we did. And it's sixth grade, so it's like this coming of age season. It's like, I don't know how old everybody else is in the room, but Degrassi was a really big deal. Y'all remember that show? And I was on a mission, like, I want to live this stuff out. I remember when Manny got her thong, and I was like, take me to, there was actually a store named Mandy's on Fifth Avenue, Park Slope. Yeah, yeah. And that's where I got my first thong. So I'm, mind you, sixth grade, 11. Like, what ass cheeks do you even have? Like, why do you need a thong? But I'm pressed. I'm ready to go there and, like, live, right? And clearly, that was the vibe of a lot of people in middle school, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. So one of the things that was really popular was, like, kind of doing everything in secret. So when we would walk to mass, that's when we would, like, talk to the other classes. I was a messenger for my friend, let her know that, oh, this guy likes you, and, you know, he wants to know when can we kiss after school. Like, literally, coordinating those messages. And of course, I wanted to do that for her because then that meant she would deliver a message for me and then that whole thing, right? But here's where it gets juicy. So we had this one friend. I told you how everybody wanted to roll up their skirts, right? And we had this one friend that honestly, it was like, she just came to school so perfect. Like, her mom was so strict that she made her come with the jumper so, like, her skirt couldn't be rolled up. And it was like, oh my gosh. I was like, I can't have you be my messenger, girl. Like, you're killing it, you know? So, lame shoes. Like, I'm telling you, we would try to, like, find somebody with old shoes to be like, okay, you can use theirs. Like, since you don't wear them anymore, like, we would try so hard to collectively hold our sister down. Cause it's like, girl, like, you really crimping the style right now. So, yeah, we would, like, try to. I remember one time specifically, her skirt was so long, like, even when we rolled it up, it kind of went to where our skirt started. And we purposely, like, used these safety pins to try to keep it up. But here's the thing. Chelsea started getting tight. She was like, I don't like how y'all think that I'm so whack just because I come here in full uniform. So what did she start doing? Rebelling. She started rebelling. And she started another throwback. Do y'all remember these sex bracelets? Yeah. So y'all gonna have to look it up. I don't know how many people are parents in here. I don't want to burst your bubble. I don't want to ruin your lives. But I will say they're called sex bracelets, but they don't all mean sex. Essentially, like, one color meant one thing. Red meant this, green meant this, right? And Chelsea start rolling up with mad bracelets, like, up here. I'm like, Chelsea, you with the no uniform, with the, you know, perfect uniform, boring shoes. You got the emblem of the jacket and the vest. You? So she's like, yeah. So then that became a thing. And I really gravitated towards Chelsea. Like, we weren't that cool, but there weren't that many black kids at the school. So just naturally, we just kind of. So when I felt like she was getting, you know, she was having lip locks and dubbing sessions at the school party, I was like, this might get me closer to Degrassi than I thought. So let me ride with her. So I would hang out with her and we would talk. I can't even tell you what I learned in sixth grade. I just remember us feverishly talking at breakfast, talking at lunch, talking after school all the time, talking on the phone. And I remember one time she was like, oh, like, I got some news. And I'm like, this is what I live for. Like, bring it on. And she's like, you know, I was in my mom's room and I was digging around and guess what I found? And I'm like, what? And she's like, a dildo. Shook. I heard about these things. You know, I clicked over to Real Sex on HBO a couple times when I was young. So I've heard about it, but in the flesh, like, I have somebody who, someone my age, they said that they saw it and it's from their mother? Honestly, I probably was mentally checked out that day. Like, nothing else mattered but that story. So we was talking about that all day. I was like, how did it look? How did you find it? What did it do? And then, like, every now and then we'll be like, should we ask about, is the size, is that weird? Should we not? No, that's nasty. And then after all these questions, we were like, what was your mom doing with that? Like, still so clueless. Like, all this still in a, like, 11-year-old mind, but it didn't click, right? So We were talking about that all day. Like, honestly, that it was the height of my life, the height of my gossip life, my gossip career. And I remember being so fixated about this that I remember seriously being on school premises with my phone being like, "Hey, Chelsea, call me later. I can't believe you say you found that dildo. Like, that's so crazy. Can't you still think it's your mom's, right? That's so nuts. Well, call me back. Bye." And I'm waiting all day. You know, I have my equivalent of flip phone, so we'll just use this. But all day I'm, you know, out of school, just looking. We normally talk all the time anyway. And I'm looking and I'm like, this is weird, you know. Chelsea, we talk all the time, but especially with a day like this, this is very important. Like, you gotta call me back. So she calls me back around like 9, though. And I remember thinking like, it's a little late, but okay, whatever. She's calling me back. And I answer the phone, "Chelsea, dildo!" And a man is on the other end of the phone. And he's like, "This is Chelsea's stepdad. I heard the voicemail that you left on my daughter's phone about my wife having a dildo." So immediately, I already knew what type of time it was. Even at 11, he wasn't into it. I knew it. Like, he didn't like that. He wasn't like, that was the main thing. Like, why are you talking about my wife having this, right? And he's like, "That's so inappropriate. Like, who taught you to talk like that?" I'm like, Chelsea? I'm like, Chelsea told me this story. Like, I'm so sorry, right? So at this point, I'm just like, just kind of squash, squash, squash. So I'm like, "I'm so sorry, sir. I'm so sorry. I have no idea what I'm talking about. I, you know, I'm just a kid, this and that." And he's like, "Mm-mm. Put your mother on the phone." Exactly. Terrible. And I'm like, "Sir, no. It doesn't have to go that far." And he's like, "Nope. I want to speak to your mother. Put your mother on the phone." So I live in this, at the time, I lived in this 3-story brownstone, and I was just kind of like, fuck it, I'm just going to walk down the stairs as slow as possible. So I'm just, you know, and my mom's cooking, so she can't hear me. Otherwise, I feel like she would have been like, "Why are you taking so long? Like, what are you doing?" But I was just kind of milking it. And he was like, "Hello," like to the point he was like, "Hello." And I'm like, "Yeah, sir, I'm going." So I finally get downstairs and it really feels like I'm about to hand my mom a grenade. Like, I'm like, you know, this is just wrong on so many levels. First of all, I'm a black child talking about adult business. You do not do that. You do not do that. Then you're talking about sex, and then you're talking about a woman and her personal product. It was just, I was just like, I'm fucked, right? So I'm passing my mom the phone and I'm just kind of mouthing like, "Don't listen to him. He's crazy. It's not what you think." Da, da, da. Like, you know, as I pass it over and I'm just, and she has the phone and I'm just kind of like, just watching like for any little indicator of how, you know, I'm backing up just in case she might swing. I'm like, So I'm watching and then she, you know, I start getting like, I hear her say, "Oh, well, that's not what," you know, I hear that, and then I hear, "Well, they're kids, and this sounds like your wife's problem." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, we're in the clear. Yeah, tell her mom, yeah." So it was so funny. So I remember getting off the phone, and the biggest burn was my mom was like, "You left that on a voicemail?" And that was the embarrassment of it all, was just kind of like, not my mom being like, "How you leave your whole undoing on a voicemail? Like, you gotta be better than that. You gotta be slicker than that." So that was, yeah, seriously, that was embarrassing. I kind of went upstairs like, thanks, like, I guess. And when I saw Chelsea the next day, I'm assuming, I asked her like, "Girl, like, what the fuck? What the fuck? What happened?" And here's the thing. This is such an old school thing. She ended up saying that, "You remember back in the day when you could call somebody and put in the 4 digits to like get to your voicemail?" So I guess because she was saying her stepdad paid the bills. He was He was expecting a phone call. He missed it. He wasn't even trying to like be overprotective or anything. And then that's what he found. Can you imagine his disappointment? Like, wait, what? So every time I pass that school, that's something that I think of. And it's a great memory for me to have before I leave New York. So farewell. Thank you.
What rolls downstairs, a loner in pairs, and makes a buzzity sound? It's long, a schlong, a marvelous dong. Everyone knows it's dildo. When it fits in a sock, feels better than cock, and unlike a man, it's slow. It vibrates a bit, feels great on your clit. Everyone knows it's dildo. It's dildo, it's dildo. It's big, it's fleshy, it's ripped. It's dildo, it's dildo. Yes, that's right, it's ripped. What fits in your crack? Some even have sacks. The penis you don't have to blow. They're not just for gays, they use double A's. Everyone knows it's dildo. A dildo dog, a dildo plane, many more vibrating toys. Just turn the knob, they buzz, they throb. Feels great for girls and boys. It's dildo, it's dildo, the sex toy that everyone likes. It's dildo, for gay men or even for dykes. What makes you come and fits in your bum? Some of them even can glow. A dink in marvelous pink. Everyone knows it's dildo. A long plushy tube, use oil-based lube, not just for the neighborhood hoes. For a girl on the go, no time for a bow. It makes for the perfect fellow. It's dildo, pink, purple, green, yellow, black, white. It's dildo, I think that I'll use one tonight.
We'll be right back.
Folks, what does it feel like to get hit by a car while biking, to be attacked by an alligator, or learn your spouse has hired someone to kill you? If those are the kinds of stories you find interesting, and of course you do, then What Was That Like is the podcast for you. What Was That Like is filled with real stories about the most surreal experiences of people's lives. On each episode, a guest comes on and tells about the time they found themselves in some type of extreme situation. Could be an animal attack, a plane crash, winning the showcase on The Price is Right, and more. There's a story about a woman whose parachute failed, a woman who was shot 12 times in the Fifth Third building in Cincinnati, Ohio, where my best friend used to work. There's a woman whose house exploded. Listen, it's all told through the lens of the person who actually experienced it. So if you want to hear some unbelievable and inspiring firsthand stories, I invite you to check out What Was That Like? Every story is verified. So you know even the most bizarre tales are someone's reality. Listen to What Was That Like on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or on the app you're using now.
No matter what you're going through, you are never alone. Join me on my podcast, From the Heart with Rachel Braithen, every Friday. Each episode is like sitting down with your best friend for a cup of coffee. From self-care tips to inspiration for healing, this podcast offers the chance to return to nature, return to community, and return to who you are at your core. Straight from my heart to yours. Listen to and follow From the Heart with Rachel Braithen on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Risk. This is Frank Zappa behind me now, and we just heard the Dildo Song by Iris and Rose. Before that, of course, we heard from Ashaya Amave, who you can find on Instagram at Ashaya Amave or at Sharing to Share. Folks, one of our Patreon patrons named Alan recently sent us this message with his donation. He said, Risk is such an important work. It has done so much for so many. I listen for entertainment and education. As an old fart, I find there is so much of life in the 2020s that is markedly different from, quote-unquote, when I was your age. Risk has helped me to better understand society and relationships today. I hope to enjoy the podcast for many decades to come. Thank you so much, Alan. The help is dearly needed and appreciated. Anyone can join us and find all of the bonus content at patreon.com/risk. And if you'd rather make a one-time donation, that's at paypal.me/riskshow. Next, we're going to hear from Hillary McCormick. Just a word of warning, there is a tragic death in this story. Hillary does a lot of amazing work as an obstetric anesthesiologist. I got that the first time, that pronunciation. She's a researcher whose main area of focus relates to improving perioperative... perioperative care for LGBTQ folks. She regularly volunteers with CASIEF in Rwanda, helping to support their anesthesia residency training program. So here is Hillary McCormick now with a story we call Connor in the Wave.
In July of 2007, I'm 20 years old, and I went to West Africa, to Liberia, to volunteer on the world's largest not-for-profit hospital ship. I was really hoping it was going to beef up my application for medical school. I had wanted to travel anyway, so exciting for that reason. And I was going to just be part of the crew. I didn't have any medical training at this point, but a ship needs crew, so I was going to be living on this ship for a month with over 400 other volunteers from more than 30 countries around the world. And it was also a non-denominational Christian-based organization. So I had a lot of feelings leading up to the departure. This was my first time traveling internationally by myself. I was really excited about going, but also really anxious about going. I really wanted to get there, and I really wanted to get back home. I was partying a lot at the time, going out blackout drunk about five nights a week, and my biggest concern was, how will I go this long without getting laid? I had no idea how I was going to deal with that, and I didn't know how all these religious people on the ship were going to be when I encountered them. Atheist, agnostic, I don't really care what you call me, but I definitely don't believe in God. I have lots of reservations about organized religion, so there was a healthy dose of nervousness about how I was going to manage living with religious people that I knew inevitably we would disagree on things. And some of those things would be deeply held core values, and I'd be stuck there. They were really good about contacting me and making sure that I would be comfortable going to them. I think the first red flag was on my application. I didn't fill out the page that was a letter of reference from my spiritual leader and also answering the question, what does Jesus mean to you? And I responded nothing. So they accepted me, but they knew that they had someone that wasn't part of the fold coming along. They assured me I would not be the first or the last like myself, so I decided it was still worth the trip. I finally get there, very difficult journey, lost luggage, somehow had a five-day layover in Jersey, of all places, but that's a whole other story. I finally get there, it's the middle of the night, and I realize that a lot of other people who have arrived in the capital of Liberia with me on my flight were also volunteers. So there's a white van that comes and meets us at the airport, and we all load in, load up our luggage, making introductions as we go, and drive off to the ship. As we're coming up, we get to a port that is guarded with these UN posted guards. There's barbed wire all around. The guards are just holding these large semi-automatic guns. It was the first time I'd seen them in person. Liberia had just come out of 15 years or so of intense civil war, and you could very much still see the effects. The telephone poles look like Swiss cheese in many places. So we go through the port security, and then we come up to our own dock because the ship has a private dock. There's more security, more barbed wire, more guards with guns. We go through that. Then there's a sole gangway onto the ship, which is this looming white ship that I could kind of see the shadow of in the darkness as we were arriving. And we go up the gangway, and then the ship's own guards are at the doors. And they aren't carrying weapons, but they are Nepalese Gurkhas, which are a military force that is renowned for their hand-to-hand combat. They're pretty intimidating. And so I'm exhausted, but adrenaline is just keeping me running at this point. And I set off with the rest of the group to get our little tour of the ship, review of the rules. Of course, there's someone from leadership who, as we're boarding, is surreptitiously looking to make sure we're complying. Clothing, we had to have our knees covered at all times. If we had tank tops on, the strap had to be at least 1 inch thick. No cleavage, and that did include if you bent over, so I don't know how that was supposed to be achieved for everyone. Safe to say, none of the clothing I brought looks like anything in my closet at home. They also explained that in our cabins, which had 10 people in a cabin, they were segregated by sex. So if you wanted to spend time with boys and girls, then you had to leave the door open. And it felt a lot like high school. We went on. I kind of suppressed my eyes rolling numerous times. They explained that there's a water limit. So when you have a shower every day, you are allowed to have 2 minutes worth of hot water usage. So one of my roommates quickly explained to me that you turn the water on, you get all wet, you turn the water off, you soap up, you turn the water on, you rinse off, and then you turn it off. I had been used to taking leisurely 45-minute showers. And if I was rushing, a half an hour. So this was something that caused me a lot of worry. They explained that there would be community meetings twice a week, which were mandatory. It didn't take me long before I realized that those were basically mass. There needs to be some way to get everyone together for important meetings when you have so many people on a ship, but also it was a Christian organization. I'm not surprised that they were going to do that. It didn't take me long to figure out how I could skip those without being noticed. If you claimed to have an upset stomach and stay in your room, they're not going to come looking for you. And while everyone's at community meetings, there is no one using the laundry, so you get to go and not wait in line, and I made good use of that. Yeah, and I was thrilled to find a group of people around my age. They were welcoming, they were friendly, and the best part was that they partied. So I got to learn all their secrets. We would ignore our 11 p.m. curfew and sneak off the ship, sneak out of the port, across the street to a local bar. And I don't know if this part is true, but they told me that at this bar, it was where all of the sex workers hung out. And so we would hang out with them, and they kind of protected us from anyone who would harass us. Obviously, they knew who we were because we were the only white people. And so we had a great time with them. Then we'd sneak back onto the ship. We had this understanding with the Gurkhas that they wouldn't say anything because they also went there on their off time and they also weren't allowed. So it all worked out. I was one of the people, along with some of my friends, who worked in the kitchen. So we would come back drunk, having exceeded the 2 beers a day limit. We would sneak into the cafeteria, make ourselves some snacks, basically be foolish, somehow not wake people up, and then we'd go back to bed and pass out. One of these people was Connor. Connor was the stereotype of your all-American football player. He was from Texas. He had messy brown hair. He had broad shoulders. He had these beautiful sparkling eyes and this smile like he always had a secret. And I had the biggest crush on him. And I wanted to do everything I could to get to know him better. He was pre-med like I was, but he had some other training, so he was on the dental team and they would go off the ship often, so I didn't get to see him as much. I was trying to figure out if he was really, how Christian was he? Was he the wait till marriage type? Was he the sneak around type? This was my focus. It really shouldn't have been, but it was. So I fell into a routine, making friends. The time was passing. It was really, really wonderful. And one weekend that I had off, I was thrilled that I got invited along with Connor and some of his friends, Dan, Beth, and Sadie, to go to a beach. And the four of them had been on the ship for a while, and they were really close. So this kind of felt like I was being brought into the circle, and I was beside myself. We have a couple of beaches that the ship has designated as safe to swim at, and they weren't particularly close. So we piled into a cab, and after nearly an hour bumpy ride, we get to this huge horseshoe-shaped beach, sandy. There's hardly anyone there because it's a Sunday and most people are at church. And we are just so excited to spend the day relaxing, tanning, ignoring the clothing rules. We go to the beach. Beth and Sadie and I wanted to tan and relax for a little bit. So we set out everything, laid out our blankets and towels and got our food kind of organized, making sure to set Connor's aside because he did not like condiments and we had to make him a special meal. Dan and Connor wanted to get right to the water, so they ran right out. And as we were kind of settling in, we did notice that they seemed to be really far from the shore, really fast. And Sadie commented on it, but we didn't think much of it and continued chatting. And then in the distance, we heard someone yell, "Help!" And we realized that they were in trouble. So we run down to the shore. We're running up and down. We can't see them. Every once in a while, we see someone's head bob up. And finally, we're able to grab Dan, and we pull him out. We're all aware that he is the strongest swimmer, so we did not want to go in the water. We're up to our knees, but we're not strong swimmers. We drag him onto the beach, and he's coughing and sputtering, and he finally manages to say that when they hit the water and their feet left the ground, it was like being flushed down a toilet. He was worried that Connor was panicking. So we get him up to his feet and we're running up and down the beach. We're screaming Connor's name. We're looking for him everywhere we can see. And there are waves at this beach. They're not massive, but they are a decent size. We are running all the way to the side on one of the edges of the horseshoe where there's all of these rocks. And as we get there, there's this huge wave that crests. And in the middle of that wave, just suspended, as though there is an invisible hand holding him around his waist, with his hair in his face and his arms and legs dangling, was Connor. And I think that's when I knew that he was dead. And I think we all did, but we didn't want to accept it. There were some locals at the beach, and they were able to grab his body before it crashed against the rocks, and we pulled him onto the sand. And Sadie was the only one of us with medical training. She was a nurse, and She knew CPR, and luckily there was one other person on the beach who actually used to be with the organization, who was a nurse, and they both started CPR right away. Alternating positions. Somebody threw me a cell phone, and I managed to catch it, and I knew this was our lifeline. It was our only way to contact the ship. And next thing I know, there's this white van that someone has driven onto the beach, and we pull Connor's body into the van. We all load in. He's still so pale. His lips are blue, and he's just not responsive at all. We show up at this clinic of sorts, which was really just a big room with maybe 6 or 8 metal stretchers, no oxygen that I could see. And we bring his body in onto one of the stretchers. And Sadie and the other person are still doing chest compressions. And I notice someone come into the room with a white lab coat on who sort of shrugs. And I can't remember if he said it to us or not, but the message was clear that he thought we were wasting our time, and he left. We couldn't stop CPR until our ship's trauma team arrived. So after 2 hours, they got there and they pronounced him dead. And everything after that is a blur. I remember standing outside the clinic and seeing people around who were openly wailing and screaming and looking at us because our group was huddled together, quietly grieving, which was very much not the cultural custom there. I remember getting back to the ship and having the leadership team relax on some of the rules. They let us overlook our water limit, and I got in the shower and I cranked the heat and I just collapsed on the ground, just sobbing. I couldn't feel anything. I was numb. I couldn't stop shaking. They said that those of us who were friends with Connor could stay in a boardroom overnight instead of having to keep the men and the women separate. And we just stayed together at some point, falling asleep out of exhaustion. Then, within a few days, arrangements were made for Beth and Sadie and Dan to go with Connor's body back to Texas to his family. I couldn't go with them. I was due to go home in a week, and I just didn't have the money to arrange to do that. And I also didn't really feel like it was my place because they were very close and I didn't know them that well yet. I stayed behind on the ship. I gave my first eulogy after knowing someone for 3 weeks in front of hundreds of people, many of whom who knew him better than I did. I took some time off of my duties, but also felt an obligation to help in some way during the last week of my time there. So I did go back for a few shifts, but I was just robotic and going through the motions. I remember my friends there who knew him. They were all trying to be so supportive while also grieving themselves. There was one night where I was sitting on the dock watching the sunset over the Atlantic Ocean, and the sunsets were beautiful there. Just streaks of purple and orange and pinks across the sky. But I didn't feel anything. And one of my friends, she came and sat next to me and she hugged me. And she said, "I don't know if you believe in heaven or God, but I do. And I know Connor's with him in a better place." And I've thought of that a lot over the last 16 years, that the comfort and the love that she gave with those words still came through more than anything else. And a week later, I was on my way home. Of course, I had told my close friends and my parents what had happened. But I don't think anyone was really ready for the state I'd be in. I don't think I was ready for it. They talk a lot about when you travel to places like where I was going for reasons like I was going, that you'll have culture shock. But no one had told me, you'll have culture shock when you come home. And it was so much worse for me. I wasn't prepared for the anger and the guilt that I would feel going back to my life in such a privileged and wasteful society. I tried to get back to my normal life. I would go out partying with my friends again, but I would drink too much, and every single night I would end up in tears. Someone would have to take me home. And after a while, I think my friends got not tired, but they'd heard the same story so many times, and they really couldn't grasp what was still so upsetting. I remember one of them asking me one night, "Were you fucking him? Why are you still so upset about this?" And it was just like a slap in the face. It's really difficult to relate to people, the kind of deep connections and relationships you build when you live, sleep, work together, and you're all in an unfamiliar environment, let alone going through trauma together. But life continues, and there's nothing you can do about it. So I kept on moving on, and I felt like I had dealt with things, or at least bottled them up. A year later, I was starting med school, and I moved to another city for that. I was living on my own for the first time. And one night I was washing my face, and I just became convinced with every fiber of my being that when I stood up, there was going to be someone behind me looking in the mirror. I started not being able to go to sleep because I was convinced that there was someone in my apartment. I was looking under the bed, opening the curtains, looking behind the shower curtain. I had sleep paralysis for the first time. And then I started to get these flashbacks with that image of Connor in the wave. And eventually I decided that I needed help, and I realized that I had PTSD. And I've done a lot of work, and I feel like I've got a lot of skills to deal with everything that has happened. I can swim in the ocean without having a panic attack for the most part. Every once in a while, a current will catch me off guard. I learned how to scuba dive this year, which was a big achievement, and I didn't panic. I've stayed in touch with my friends from the ship over the years, a core group of us more than others. But I know we're all still connected. We still have certain phrases that nobody else would know even after all this time. When people talk about a trauma bond, it's not just a figure of speech, it's cemented. Those people will always be a part of me. I do a lot of global health work, and I still do now, but before the pandemic, I used to spend 1 or 2 weeks a year in Ghana, in West Africa. And every time I would go, I would make a point to go spend some time walking along the beach by myself, even for a minute or two, looking out across the Atlantic on the opposite side from where I live, and think about Connor, think about everything he wanted to accomplish. And even though I'm still not religious, I'd like to think about him being out there somewhere, his energy maybe, and just thanking him for being an inspiration to me. And I hope that I can keep that sense of passion about helping others, which has been tested over the last few years, especially working in healthcare. But I just hope that I can continue to have half of the morals and ambition and ideals that he demonstrated to me in the time that I knew him.
This is Tung behind me now, and we just heard from Hillary McCormick, who you can find on Instagram at Hillary Pop. Folks, it won't be too long now before I'm certified in generative coaching. And once I'm certified, I'm going to raise the price closer to industry standards. But right now, you can set up an appointment with me for a sort of training day's rate. If you visit kevinallison.com, let's talk about creativity or new pursuits in your life or your journey with sex, romance, kink, your gender, or maybe a check-in about your relationship with yourself, your self-love. Maybe you'd like to learn new methods of meditation, or maybe you're neurodivergent like me and working on that. There are so many things. People set up appointments to spend co-creative time with me, holding space for you to get out of your own way for a moment and let new ideas, new attitudes, new game plans emerge. If you want to know more, just email me at kevin@risk-show.com. Folks, on Thursday, we revisit a story about a marriage that lasted 3 days, and a woman mistaken for a fertility goddess. But that's Thursday, and folks, today's the day. Take a risk.